that's another, I would say, thing that's probably counterintuitive to most of your listeners. And that is, you want your attorney to be friendly with the opposing counsel. Absolutely. You want your accountants to be friendly, because you that will save you so much money.
Hi, my name is Mina Kim, your host of The Click Line. I've worked on Wall Street for over 14 years. Then I built out Orange Theory Fitnesses and sold them to a private equity firm. And upon that exit, started investing in women and minority startups, as well as advising women who are getting divorced with financial consulting and strategy. Welcome to The Click Line. Today we have Marie Ebersbacher. She is the Senior Managing Director and Head of CBIZ Advisory Group's Forensic and Financial Services, as well as the Forensic Consulting Group. Her group has over 300 professionals nationwide, and CBIZ has over 10,000 professionals nationwide as the seventh largest accounting firm in the nation. She specializes in complex litigation, including multi-year and multi-account tracing and accounting, forensic investigation, and business valuation. Marie has performed analysis on hundreds of complex engagements, hundreds if not thousands. She is what the young generation would call the spill detective, because she's got all the tea. Welcome, Marie, to The Click Line.
Thank you. Wow, I've never heard that before. That's new.
Yeah, so if for the audience, could you talk a little bit about what is forensic accounting and investigation, and what areas that your group works on?
So our group, we do all of the forensic accounting. So we do the complex marital dissolution, but we also do fraud investigation, economic damages. We do, so that's personal injury, that's business interruption, IP damages, lost profits. We also do a lot of business valuation, both in the litigation context, non-litigation context, like employee stock option purchase plans and things like that. We have within advisory a valuation group that specializes a lot in the non-litigation valuation area. We have, white collar crime investigation group. We have I'm trying to think of all of the different areas. My specialty in particular is the complex family law. We also have a pretty robust cryptocurrency group that has grown quite a bit over the last couple of years.
And so when you're brought in for marital dissolutions, what areas do you particularly focus on? Is it business valuation? Is it more that your time is spent on forensic accounting and trying to trace accounts that may be international, et cetera?
It depends on the jurisdiction. So family law is one of those things that is very state specific. So in California, most of our work is really focused on complex tracing. So we do a lot of 10, 15, 20, sometimes 30 plus year tracings of bank accounts, going and looking at, because in California, you can trace your separate property back before marriage. And if you can do that, then, and you have the records, you can capture some of that outside of the marital estate. Outside of California, primarily the business valuation is the largest component of the dissolutions.
And so, speaking of business valuations, you know, my background, I used to work on Wall Street in hedge funds. And so I'm curious about, how do you value something like a hedge fund or a private equity fund? when there's so many factors that will affect a fund in any given year, depending on the cycle, how many partners you have, inflows, outflows from institutional investors? How do you approach something complex like that?
Well, when you're talking about hedge funds and things like that, it's very complicated, and you need someone who's very specialized, very used to doing those kinds of valuations. Very often, you want to, first off, stay away from the 409A valuations and the valuations that are done for investment purposes, partly because family law is a different standard of value than the standard of value that is used for those types of valuations. So it's really critical to understand and measure your expectations differently than you would from an investment standpoint. You know, when you're an investor, particularly in a startup, there's a different horizon that you're looking at, right? They're looking at the long-term returns, the long-term benefits. So you're looking at a cash flow statement and you're seeing nothing but negative, right? Money going out, negative, negative, negative. There's no value in family law to that business because it could just as easily be zero as it could be the next unicorn. So in a family law context, that number is zero. It's not $25 million or $45 million or whatever number that a 409A might put on it because of the projections that they're putting on it based on the forecast that management has put on the disruption that they are anticipating. It's an entirely different set of assumptions because you can only deal with what is known or knowable as of that date of valuation.
Right.
You can't forecast the kind of upside that you might be able to do when you're thinking of an investment. So it's a much different animal, and the expectations have to be tailored that way.
And so if I was someone who was going through the process and there were shares in a startup, it makes sense to hold the shares, right?
Divide and kind.
Yes, because then you can wait for the upside if there is ever one, and not taking, you know, a loss for it. And so you mentioned crypto.
Yes.
Which is a very popular topic. And, you know, the very theory or thesis in crypto is being untraceable. How do you go about tracing or finding people's crypto? Is it even possible?
It is, and I do it by calling my partner, Victoria Fife, and she does it. It's very, very specialized. You really have to know what you're doing. There are certifications now, and it's more traceable than it used to be. Certainly, you know, when you set up the accounts and you know what to look for, it's a much more transparent process, particularly in your average, I would call it the average divorce. Someone who sets up a Coinbase account, set up a Robinhood account or something, it's much more traceable because there's a bank account associated with it. You know, there was an initial transaction. And usually Victoria is very adept at finding that. She makes crypto seem much more secure than regular fiat currency, which I now know to mean regular currency. But it actually is easier to trace than it used to be because there's always a bank account that it starts with. When we're talking about traditional, you know, your typical divorce. Now, if you have someone who is very adept at cryptocurrency, who is purposely using crypto to hide things, you need someone like Victoria, who's very, very specialized. But if you just have, you know, a family that happened to have cryptocurrency that maybe doesn't disclose it in the divorce, but someone says, well, I thought we had a Coinbase account, or I thought we had, you know, that we can usually locate it, and then we can use Victoria to just trace it It's not as complicated. It actually can be done. And it's coming up more and more, that's for sure. It's definitely, you know, most people have at least dabbled, at least gone out and bought maybe some Ethereum, maybe not going out and buying a few Bitcoin, but they're at least going out and buying, you know, a little bit of crypto just to see what happens.
And so what would you say are some of the common issues that you see in the cases that you deal with?
I think probably one of the major issues is disclosure, but I want to be clear that it's unintentional missed disclosure. So it's people that forget that they had a 401k from a prior employer. And so they didn't, you know, so you have to make sure that you're asking enough questions so that everything is being disclosed so that it can be divided. That's a big one. The Coinbase account, the things that, you know, somebody might have bought, they might have bank accounts. Yeah, I'm sure many of your listeners have gotten that letter from the state of California, or the state of New York, or wherever, that says we have unclaimed property, and it's that bank account that they forgot that they had. And so it just so happens it gets turned over to the state. It's that kind of thing. There is a fair amount of, you know, where somehow middle of the dissolution, we find out that there's an account that somebody didn't know about. It's very rare that it's intentional. I would say that 80% of the time when someone believes that there's some, you know, he or she is hiding money, and it's generally either A, not true, or B, not worth chasing. Unfortunately, we have spent a lot of money chasing things that 90%, 95% of forensic accountants will tell you the same thing. This is not just me. It's not just that I'm bad at my job, and so we don't find it. Most forensic accountants will tell you the exact same thing, that most allegations of hiding money during divorces, it's just not there. People are just very suspicious during divorces. It's very common, but it really just is not as common. It doesn't happen as much as people think. And we've gone through and, you know, looked at every bank statement, captured every dollar, looked at every distribution. You know, I mean, and when you've identified every single dollar that hits the tax return, and you've traced it to every dollar in the bank accounts, or you've spent, I've seen clients spend, you know, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 on bank traces, which means it's not just the bank accounts that someone is disclosing. They're literally tracing, blanket tracing every single bank account in the United States, and to see if someone has a different bank account that they haven't, and nothing comes up. I mean, can you imagine spending that kind of money? So it's just the cost benefit's not worth it. Or you look at the lifestyle, and somebody still wants to spend $70,000 to do that. And even if you found some money, it's not going to be enough to make a difference. And so we spend a great deal of time trying to talk our clients out of paying us to do those kind of things. You know, so because even if we found something, it's just not going to be enough to change their lifestyle, to change the end result of the dissolution, because California is a no-fault state, right? So for us, in fact, most states are no fault.
Right.
In most cases, it's just not worth it. So even if there was anything, it's not worth it. So, but I would say almost every forensic accountant will tell you that most allegations, even if we investigate them, just don't end up being true. Now, we've all had cases where it's been true and it's been egregious. You know, we had one where it was $30 million overseas. That was worth it. That was real.
Where overseas?
In Hong Kong. So, and we've got one right now where we're pretty sure that's where it's at. It's a popular place to put your money, I guess.
Low taxes.
Yeah. So, I mean, it definitely happens. It does happen, but it has to be a lot of money for it to make sense for us to go chasing it.
And so when you're brought into a case, I assume for these high net worth cases, each side has their own forensic accounting firm involved, or is it one that's brought in and you guys, you know, have to agree on the valuation as a group, or how does that work?
Typically, there's one on each side. I'm going to say something that's going to be, it's going to sound counterintuitive. That makes, if you have two good forensic accountants, you're going to save a lot of money having two versus having one. Because one is going to end up with three. Because first off, I won't do joint work anymore. I won't be a joint forensic accountant anymore, because the only time that you have the right answer as a joint forensic is when both sides hate you, right? When both sides think you're wrong, you have the right answer. Because if one side is like, good job, great, you're a genius, you clearly have the wrong answer. Because somebody is, it can't possibly be correct. And so what ends up happening is, since both sides are upset with your opinion because neither one of them got what they want, they each hire their own forensic. So you end up with three forensic accountants. And so what ends up happening is what should have happened in the beginning is those three people get together, they figure out where they have differences. And there's three ways that accountants have differences. The first is data, right? There's just different data. There's the difference in information from the clients, right? The clients are testifying differently. She says that this was a business trip that they went on based on her work. And he says, no, that's a vacation that we took because so that's part of our lifestyle, or vice versa, right? So one is a component of the lifestyle. One is actually just a business expense. And then the third is the applied legal theory, right? That one side wants to argue that this is an apportionment based on efforts, which gets the community a larger portion of the estate. And the other side wants to argue, no, it's not based on efforts. It's just based on my compensation. And that gets the community a smaller portion. So that's a legal theory issue. So those are the things that can affect an expert's opinion. And so what happens is those three people get together and they figure out where those three are different, and they boil those down. And then the expert's opinions are not that far off, because good experts don't have really diverging opinions most of the time once those three things are boiled down. And good experts will say, okay, if you agree that if the legal was this, then the answer is this, because we can all do the math. And if it's this, then this is the answer. And that's what good experts should do. And so that's why if you have two good experts, they're going to do that anyway. You don't need to have the third one that just made everybody mad in the beginning to start with. So I actually have a case right now that where the judge, there are two good experts on each side, but the attorneys, the attorneys don't like each other. And so they wouldn't let the experts do a lot of meet and confers to get that, boil it down. And so there was so much testimony in court where the accountants were so far apart that the judge literally ordered, you will get a joint expert, and I will not hear from your experts again. I don't want any dueling expert testimony. I'm done. And so in that one, I agreed to be the joint only because I know the two experts and I know they're smart. I know they know what they're doing. And so I said, okay, I will play referee. And so in that case, I literally am just the referee. I'm in the middle and I'm like, okay, you're right about this and you're right about that. And so we've kind of boiled it down into the if this, then this, and we're going to go to trial and I'm the only one that's going to testify. So that one's kind of been fun.
Why do you think they were so far apart?
It literally is based on what the clients are testifying to. She says this was a gift. He says it wasn't. One side says that it's based that the business apportionment, because it's a separate property business. One side says it should be apportioned based on the husband's efforts. The other side says it shouldn't. It should be based on his compensation. The biggest difference is one side says that husband was overcompensated, and that this is a legal theory. A portion should be carved out as his separate property. The other side says no, he paid himself W-2 wages. That should all be community property. So that's a legal theory. Almost all of it, there's almost no difference once you boil it down to those three things. But because they weren't really allowed to meet and confer and really boil it all down before that all blew up, the judge just got super frustrated.
Wow. And so how often in court do you see like the attorneys who really don't like each other and the forensics who, or other team members where they really like butt heads? Because I'm sure since you've been to so many cases and you, like everyone knows you in California, et cetera. So everyone kind of knows each other, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the people that are really, that do the high asset cases, the complex cases, it's a small community. I mean, there's probably 50 people, maybe, I guess, but it's a pretty small community. And I would say 90% of them get along really, really well. That's another, I would say, thing that's probably counterintuitive to most of your listeners. And that is, you want your attorney to be friendly with the opposing counsel. Absolutely. You want your accountants to be friendly, because that will save you so much money and so much time. I have a case right now. We are going on, I think it's day 65 of a trial. It's being tried in phases. We just finished phase 4. We got the decision yesterday. We just finished phase 4. Phase 4 was supposed to be 5 days. It went 20 because opposing counsel is so bad and so caustic. He hates everybody. Like, he has been admonished by the court repeatedly for being unnecessarily rude and just aggressive, and he won't let his expert meet and confer, and he doesn't even communicate with his expert. He's constantly personally attacking opposing counsel and our client and me and everyone on our team. Like, he is unbelievable. And what has happened? Days and days and days and days of trial. And unfortunately, my client's the wealthy one, and so he's paying for all this. But his client is paying in losing every single issue because he can't get out of his own way. He won't listen to his accountant. He won't let his accountant meet and confer. So it's like watching a bad train wreck. And we're getting ready to go into the last phase of the trial in October and November, and it's going to be 25 days. It's scheduled for 25 days. God knows how long it's going to go. We'll be in trial next year, I'm sure. But it's horrible. So you absolutely want your accountants and your attorneys to get along, because it will benefit you hugely. They're not going to be plotting behind your back. Mm-hmm. They're not going to be telling your secrets. What's going to happen is it's going to be a lot harder for anything negative to happen, because they're friends. It's going to be harder for your ex to say, hey, I want you to be aggressive and mean, and I want you to make her pay, because that attorney's going to say, no, we're not going to act like that. So it's definitely better for you if everybody gets along.
And that makes me think of a couple of things. One, that he needs therapy, but
yes, he does.
Also, that sometimes, you know, when people are first going through this process, they're interviewing matrimonial attorneys and not knowing, because if you've never done it before, you don't know who to talk to. You might get referrals from friends, and then you know, you might be like, oh no, this attorney is too expensive, XYZ. But really, you're trying to fit there has to be a personality fit, and also expertise fit. But this is so important. What you mentioned is the attorney needs to be local and knows the other players, is familiar with other attorneys, has respect and a reputation in the courts. And this you may have to pay up for. And on a blended return, maybe the same as the guy who maybe seems 30% cheaper, but he's a jerk and no one likes him type of deal. Yeah. So I think that's a really good point that you make there, because at the end of the day, no one wants to go for 65 days or any days in court, really. So you have to think of the big picture and long term of how you want to resolve this and come out of it for what's best for you and your family.
Yeah, no, you definitely get what you pay for. And if someone tells you that nobody likes them and that they're the whistleblower and they're the one who is the big bad wolf of the family law community, and that's, you know, that makes them better, that probably doesn't. That probably tells you more about them than you think, you know. So you definitely want, I would look for AAML attorneys, American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers, and that's a national organization. They don't have to be AAML attorneys, but I would definitely recommend it as a starting point. Certified family law specialists. You know, these are people who have gone that extra mile, just like CPAs, certified public accountants. To me, we've gone that extra mile to get those certifications. Just shows a little extra effort. I think that it's a good starting point. I think that's important. So I would definitely recommend it.
Absolutely. And one topic that does come up frequently as well is real estate. As you know, it's a tough market right now. And it was really, you know, doing well 2021, rates were down 2.5-3%, and now it's 7-8. And so there could be families who bought then and the values have come down. But what are some ways you've kind of like worked around that? Because in valuing, right? Because right now it might not be valued at what you bought it at, but maybe in a couple of years, if rates come down, there could be a change. So that's kind of like a hard issue to get your hands around.
Well, I mean, the upside of the down market right now is you're buying an asset that you know, you're buying an asset in the divorce that you know is going to go back up. Right? There's no question. If you know you're going to stay there, you want to stay there, then you're receiving an asset that will absolutely increase in value, and you're getting it at the low point. That's not a bad thing. It's definitely better than getting it at the highest possible point, right? If you paid for it and you had to buy out $800,000 of equity, and then it went down. Right now, let's say you're buying out $200,000 of equity. Chances are you might be fighting over it with your ex-spouse. The hard thing right now is if you have that 2-4% rate that's fixed, and you have to buy out your spouse, and you have to refinance that mortgage. That is the real challenge right now. And so it's quite possible that you have to negotiate out of something else. So you kind of have to consider that as a possibility, and it might be worth it. So that a lot of people get fixated, especially in California. So
right,
in equitable distribution states, it's not 50-50. They could go 80-20 on some assets, and so it's not necessarily 50-50. In California, we're very much 50-50, and that's the goal. So people get very fixated on that. But it could be that if your spouse agrees to stay on the mortgage so that until rates come down, you say, hey, I'm going to give you an extra $100,000. I'm going to give you an extra $50,000. It's relative to the size of the estate, whatever it is. Or I'm going to take all of the retirement assets that have a tax basis that is much lower, so that I'm going to get hit with all those taxes in the long run, not you. And you can take all the cash assets so that you don't have those tax issues in exchange for me staying, for you staying on the mortgage until I can refinance it at that low rate. You know, you have to be creative about how you negotiate these things. And that way you can actually stay on it. That's really where the problem is. The low values are a blessing right now. It's if you're the one buying out. If you're the one being bought out, that's a shame. But you can, if you want to refinance the mortgage, you may have to give up something else, but you can be creative about it. You just have to be open-minded that you can't have everything, right? You have to be creative.
Right. Well, I love that creative solution you just provided, because I think a lot of people don't even know that's possible. So it's also so important to have someone like you on their team to come up with these different solutions. And also, I've heard of the spouses being able to assume the mortgage. Granted, they can qualify it, and so removing the name of the other spouse, but keeping that rate and assuming the mortgage. But how difficult is that?
It's pretty difficult right now because the banks are not very cooperative.
Yeah, for good reason.
You have to have an assumable mortgage. And the banks, I mean, obviously, they're in no hurry to do that because they know that if you have to refinance it, they're going to get a much higher interest rate.
Right. Yeah, that's good to know. Okay, great. And so what would you say is, you know, one of the most rewarding cases you've worked on?
Well, I can think of two. They both have to do with baseball. I'd never been to a baseball game ever. And I worked on the divorce for one of the owners of the San Diego Padres.
Oh.
I worked for the husband, and actually one of my best friends worked for the wife. She was on the wife's side. And it was fine. It was great, actually. Everybody worked very well together. In fact, toward the end of that case, I pretty much was almost the joint expert, because the attorneys on the other side, my best friend and the attorney she worked for, I had done tons of work for previously, and they weren't really in love with the expert they were using on that case, who now is one of my partners, by the way. It's a small world. That was many years later, because this was way back in 2008, I think, 2009. And so it was a very good group of people, and we got it all settled, and it was a big divide by two. So it was just getting our arms around everything. But I'd never been to a baseball game ever. And so John invited me and my family. And so we took my husband's sister and her family. And so we had field seats, and we went down, and I sat down, and I just thought, can he even see if I leave? Because I'm not sitting through nine innings or whatever this is. This is crazy.
They are long games, yeah.
I was like, ugh, you know. And I don't know what happened, but like seventh inning or something, I looked up and I'm like, oh no, it's almost over. I just fell in love with baseball. Just fell in love with it. And so we ended up like buying a condo that looks into the field, and I had season tickets for years, and I'm just like a crazy fan. So it's like the only thing I ever like settled down on. But that whole case was great because we really did some creative things to divide everything because it was very complicated. And he remains a friend to this day. And I have a lot of clients that stayed, you know, I stayed friends with. And in fact, another one of my clients, I shared my season tickets with for years. Her husband and her they'd started a business. They were in the process of selling that business. And so we were talking about, you know, her staying in, and she said, "No, you know, I just want to be bought out." And I said, "Well, I can tell you right now, if we value the business from a family law perspective, it will not value for what it will sell for, because it's a business that is being in an industry that is sought after for synergistic purposes. You know, there are companies that will buy it out based on, you know, being able to either take it out as a competitor or create, you know, other synergies. So I'm never going to be able to give you a value in family law like it could get in the marketplace." And so she said, "I don't care. You know, I really just want, you know, X dollars. And if I get X dollars, I'm good." And I said, "Okay, well, realize that you will be in, you know, at a Christmas party or something at some point, and you will find out he got three times that, you know, and you have to be okay with that." And she said, "I don't care. As long as I have this, I'm fine." You know, she had a number in her head. And I said, "Okay, well, let's talk to him." You know, and so her attorney, and her attorney actually was the opposing counsel in that other case that I was working with. And he said, of course, her husband said yes. He was like, "Of course, are you kidding me?" And so he paid her that, and she was perfectly thrilled. And he did get, I think, almost four times more. She would have gotten almost four times more than that when he finally sold the business a year later. And she was thrilled. She didn't care. She said, "It's all going to the kids anyway. What's the difference?" She was perfectly fine, but very happy. I told her, "You should write a book on divorce, you know." But, you know, there comes a point where there's just so much money that what's the point? You know, you're really fighting over the kids' money. And she didn't care. So, and she was so happy. Like, I mean, that really is, I think a lot of clients forget that there's a huge asset that they could get, and that is happiness, right? That's the asset that you want, happiness. Let it go, because that really, the ability to torture the other person seems to be the asset that many people hang on to. And that, I've told many clients that the asset that you're buying is the one that they're holding on to, which is the ability to torture you. If you're paying extra in order to settle a case, you are paying extra to get that asset away from them. And they pay extra to do that. I mean, unfortunately, that's the truth, because they want the happiness asset just to be done. And it really, the ability not to have to live your divorce every morning till every evening is an asset that is worth paying for a lot of times. I mean, many people look at it like the other person won. It's not it at all. I mean, the clients of mine that gave up early and said, "I don't care, I'm paying it," or I don't need it," definitely the happiest people by far.
Yes, that's a good point. Sometimes the cost of dragging it out for years and paying for the whole team and the emotional trauma that's being prolonged, it's not worth essentially that happiness and the peace that you want in order to continue to the next level in your life, next chapter, right? Yeah. Great. And so, as you know, the name of the podcast is called Click Line, When Everything Clicks. So when was there a moment, either personal or professional, that something clicked for you?
Well, I went to USC in California, And I was a finance major, wasn't really quite sure what I was going to do with that. And I went to a finance club meeting and my senior year, and a gentleman from Arthur Andersen came and spoke to our group about litigation consulting. And I had never heard of such a thing. And he got up there and started talking about forensic accounting. And I've told many people this. It was very much like the sky opened up. I couldn't believe it. That was perfect. You know, the combination of numbers and litigation and legal, I just thought this is perfect. This couldn't be more perfect. I was so excited. I immediately went home and wrote out 6 letters to all big, it was Big Six then, to all of the consulting groups of all 6 accounting firms, because I had no idea how else to do it. And I interviewed with all of them and went to work for Coopers & Lybrand. So I started with a litigation group, but I've done nothing but litigation, except for my 500 audit hours I had to do for my CPA license. I've done only litigation for my entire career.
Wow.
It clicked right in.
It clicked early.
Very
early. And lucky, you're very lucky it clicked early and you're divinely led to it at a finance meeting. So everyone go to your career meetings, group meetings.
Well, and I lived 96 miles from my school and I commuted. So I actually had to drive down for that meeting and I'm sure I didn't want to go. I'm sure I did not really want to drive down for that meeting, but I went. So clearly there was a plan.
Oh my God, that's amazing. That's an amazing story. I don't think I've heard of anyone, you know, going to a college meeting and then finding their career path, like the destiny career path from it like that. So that's definitely a blessing.
Yes, very lucky.
Well, thank you so much, Marie, for being on the Click Line. I know you are very busy and I appreciate you and the audience will as well with all of your knowledge. So thank you for being here today.
No, I was very happy to do it. Thank you for having me.
Don't forget to send in your questions and comments to the Click Line. And one more thing, the views and opinions expressed on this podcast are for informational and entertainment purposes only and should not be considered professional advice. Please consult with qualified professionals for advice related to your specific situation.